It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, Governor Walker has proposed far-reaching changes to the state's Department of Natural Resources. We'll look at the details.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of Wisconsin's top news stories, from UW system budget cuts to a town hall meeting about the Toma VA controversy.
WPR's assistant news director, Noah Ovshinsky, joins us now to talk about all of that and more. Noah, welcome back.
It is good to be here. Happy Friday, Veronica.
Same to you, Noah. Well, one surprise this week, to dig right in, was something that wasn't actually in the governor's speech at all. It was something that blew up anyway, though. This is controversy over the fate of the longstanding Wisconsin IDEA. How did that unfold?
Yeah, I mean, to say this was probably potentially the biggest story of the week, I think would be an understatement. It was huge. At some point in the budget writing process, and this is something that spans multiple months, the statutory wording, thank you very much, that makes up the Wisconsin IDEA, which we talk a lot about in the state, it was removed essentially from the university's mission, and language added that suggested the mission should also be to address the state's workforce needs. I mean, this was a huge change.
Now, this is a complicated one, so let's take it step by step. Square one, what happened?
Right, so I don't want to get into the weeds too much because it is a kind of a complicated story, but I think it would really be helpful to go in chronological order. So this all came to a head on Wednesday, this previous Wednesday, a day after the governor's budget address. And when this change in the university's mission came to light, it created, I mean, a social media firestorm. I mean, Twitter just blew up. Facebook blew up. And there was a lot of public outcry. That day, Walker was asked about the change while traveling around the state. And at the time, he didn't really express any concerns about it. He said that learning was important, but that most important was an education that helped somebody get a job. And I'm paraphrasing there. A bit later, though, the governor's office backtracked, released a statement, and said actually this whole change to the Wisconsin IDEA and the mission, it was a drafting error, and that the Wisconsin IDEA would remain part of the mission.
Sort of the end of a story, except that it wasn't really the end of the story. The Journal Sentinel took it further, dug a little deeper, and what did they say and what did they find?
Right, so that was just the beginning. And the Journal Sentinel published a story featuring some notes that actually accompany the budget as it goes through this the various drafts and goes through the various agencies. These notes essentially follow the drafting of the budget. And they show that the Walker administration specifically asked for these changes. Not only that, but other documents show that the Walker administration on a few occasions actually refused requests by the UW system to restore the Wisconsin IDEA. So it sort of calls into question this whole idea of whether or not it was a drafting error.
So a lot going on there. As far as a final verdict, where are we today?
Right. Well, yesterday the governor called it, he went back from calling it a drafting error. He called it a simple miscommunication. And his budget director, Michael Heifetz, ultimately took responsibility for the error. For what it's worth, PolitiFact rated the governor's drafting error explanation as a pants on fire. They said, quote, the claim was not only inaccurate, but ridiculous.
All right. So that is a story that certainly blew up this week. As you said, maybe the biggest story this week. But the budget itself was a huge story this week and everything that surrounded that. And including that here is the $300 million budget cut, proposed budget cut, I should say, to the UW system. Does this proposed cut and this controversy in general come at an awkward time for the governor with this proposed cut on the table?
Yeah, definitely. Right up until Wednesday, the governor, I think, was having, from his perspective and from many people's perspective, a spectacular few weeks. He made a great impression at a big event in Iowa where potential presidential candidates were making their pitch to Republican primary voters. He's been raising a lot of money, recruiting top-notch campaign staff for this potential presidential run. And the national media has discovered he is a serious candidate. At a time when he is, again, trying to run for president and has to sell this budget to the legislature, a budget that calls for cutting the UW by $300 million and creating this independent authority, you know, this whole issue with the Wisconsin IDEA, it's definitely a speed bump. to say the least. And in fact, already the governor has said he is willing to revisit some of the proposed cuts that he's willing to make to the UW if the revenue estimates, if that, you know, if the financial outlook for the state improves when the taxes come in.
So some impact there. Maybe we're looking at some changes. An interesting story to follow for sure. And have the Democrats said anything about all of this?
Oh, yeah. You betcha. You bet. You know, the Dems, who currently have very little sway in the legislature, frankly, took advantage of this story and have really run with it. Senate Democratic Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling said if Walker was going to blame rogue staffers, and that's the word that he used, that it raised serious questions about who is actually running the state government and writing the budget while he is on the campaign trail running for president. So definitely the Democrats are seizing on this deletion of the Wisconsin idea from the budget.
So let's look deeper at that proposed $300 million cut to the UW system. Where does that stand right now?
So, right, this, you know, news of this broke, you know, more than a week ago. But he did talk about it again in his address this week. You know, what we're seeing this week is more reaction to this plan, this idea of cutting the university by $300 million and then creating an independent authority for it so that it essentially has more control over its future. UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank told the Regents yesterday that if these cuts go through, you know, other universities will come in and poach the best students and faculty. Yesterday during the Regents meeting, she already gave an example. She said there is already a casualty as a result of all this debate over the cuts. She says the School of Medicine and Public Health, which is, you know, a very well-known school here at UW-Madison, it was just about to hire a top researcher, but that person backed out because of what they read about what was going on with the budget.
And in terms of what the campuses might be doing to react and to answer to this $300 million proposed cut, what are we hearing?
Yes, several campuses have already or are planning to launch letter campaigns directed towards lawmakers and the governor. They're asking alumni and others to tell those in charge of the budget, you know, to shrink the cut. UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank again, she sent out a mass email yesterday to alumni. Officials at UW-Whitewater and UW-Milwaukee are also looking to start a similar write-in campaign.
All right, we're going to step away from the budget debate for a bit and pick up a story out of Toma. And this one centers around the Toma VA and an alleged overuse of opioids there. What's the latest? What's been happening in Toma?
Right. So there was a town hall meeting at the American Legion in Toma. And this really was the first sort of public meeting where people could come together, different stakeholders, and talk about this ongoing debate, controversy, really, about the alleged misuse or misprescription, I should say, the overprescribing of painkillers at the Toma VA. It was organized by Western Wisconsin state lawmakers. And I talked to Maureen McCollum, the reporter here at WPR, who attended it. And, you know, she said it was really an emotionally charged meeting. You know, of course, this is a federal issue, but the state lawmakers who organized it, you know, they wanted to hear these stories, the stories that people had about the VA, and, you know, if necessary, put pressure on members of Congress to ensure that there is some sort of accountability.
And what did people say? Who showed up?
Right. So there are about 30 or 40 people who attended, and most of the people there took the opportunity to speak. People said, you know, many people said they got good care at the VA, that they didn't want the VA to get a bad reputation. Parents spoke about the care their children received, and it was really an emotionally charged meeting. Veterans, though, also were concerned about some of the negative publicity. Many said they had a good experience with the VA and just wanted to make sure that, you know, this controversy was cleared up. Former staff also spoke, and some of them have either retired early or quit because of the leadership at the VA.
And so a lot of people speaking out at this town hall meeting. Is this unusual, or were people speaking out before this?
From what I understand, this was a bit of a catharsis. Apparently, there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the leadership at the VA, and this was an opportunity for people to really speak up. They feel like, you know, before they were scared to do it. Now, they're not. You know, some said they wanted an independent investigation into the prescription practices there. Some of the people that spoke said, you know, they don't think the VA can police itself. Right now, the VA is actually conducting two internal investigations. One is looking at whether painkillers were being overly prescribed. Another is looking at the culture of intimidation and fear that some say exists at the VA. But some of the people, especially who work there or who have worked there, said, look, an independent agency should come in here and take a look at it.
An unfolding story at the Tome of VA. Noah, thank you so much for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
We've been speaking with our news guy, Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Governor Walker has proposed fundamental changes to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources in his two-year budget.
The changes include halting land conservation purchases for 13 years, removing the Natural Resources Board and State Agriculture Board's ability to set policy, cutting 66 positions, some of which are already vacant, and decreasing funding by over $13 million.
Walker's spokesperson Laurel Patrick said that the changes, quote, are part of the governor's proposal to streamline state government services and make government more efficient, more effective, and more accountable. A Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has already come out against some parts of this proposal.
Here with us now to look at the details of the governor's proposal is Michael Kraft, Professor Emeritus of Public and Environmental Affairs at UW-Green Bay. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
Well, let's talk first about the boards that would be changed. In specific, the board being changed from a policymaking body to an advisory body. How would that work?
Well, a policymaking body implies that the board is going to have some significant say over the direction of the DNR, particular enforcement actions, and general policy. I think the concern here is if you make the board purely advisory, in effect, you've removed it from the decision-making process. I think the fear is that the DNR staff will simply not listen to the board anymore. And it's particularly interesting, this is a 7-member board appointed by the governor for 6-year terms. Currently, there are 5 appointees from Governor Walker. And the former DNR Secretary George Meyer and most of the state environmental groups are very strongly opposed to this particular proposal. As George Meyer put it, this is the final removal of citizen-based conservation in Wisconsin. It gives all of the power to political appointees of the governor. So although it sounds like a modest step, we're going to, instead of being part of the policymaking process, it would be advisory, the board can still speak, the secretary of the DNR can still listen to the advice, but I think the fear is it will not work out that way.
What does the State Agricultural Board do, if you can give a specific example or two, and how would that change under this new proposal?
Well, I think the main concern that I've seen on the part of previous DNR secretaries and environmental groups is that currently when a subject is up for discussion by the DNR secretary, there would be considerable citizen input. There might be public hearings. The advisory board could bring any number of different perspectives to bear. Maybe the issue is mining in the northern part of the state, or maybe the issue is groundwater contamination caused by animal feedlots, which has been a big concern in the rural areas. And I think there's been a fear that in this administration that is under Governor Walker, the DNR has become a little bit more pro-business and has listened less to environmental and public health concerns. And so I think many people view this proposal as part of this larger shift away from a conservation organization and one dedicated to environmental protection to one that's going to be a little friendlier to business community, with streamlined regulations, with a reduction in staff, which we can talk about separately. So I think the DNR advisory, the Natural Resources Board, to make that an advisory body, I think the fear is this is part of a larger package that's to decrease the visibility of the decision-making within the DNR and to remove from a position of policymaking the kind of input that many people around the state would value.
Now, Governor Walker has said that this would make government more effective, more efficient and accountable. Has the Natural Resources Board been troubled by inefficiency in the past?
Well, I don't think so. But language like efficiency and effective and streamlining, they mean different things to different people. Streamlining regulation sounds like a good idea until you realize it maybe decreases the opportunity for public involvement or gives a little more weight to large business operations in the state than to others. And I think that's the concern that's been raised, really, is whether Wisconsin citizens will have the same degree of participation and involvement in DNR decisions that they have had in the past. That is certainly what George Meyer has said. It's certainly what the League of Wisconsin League of Conservation Voters said, as they put it. The very last thing Wisconsin needs when it comes to natural resources is more politics guiding the decisions. And I think the fear is that the DNR secretary, who was, of course, appointed by the governor, would gain authority and the DNR Natural Resources Board and citizens in general would lose power. And so I think some view this as just too much consolidation of power in the governor's appointee and a reduction in the impact that citizens have had on the DNR.
Now, we've been talking about the Natural Resources Board so far. As far as the State Agriculture Board, what do you see them doing and what could change?
Well, I know less about that. I haven't followed that as much. But I think it's part of the same proposal. Governor Walker is, of course, and I think anyone who's followed the budget debate this week over the Wisconsin idea and, of course, the proposed cuts to Wisconsin Public Radio knows there's a kind of larger concern driving these changes, which is to reduce the role of government and to streamline decision-making. And, again, to some that sounds like a good idea, but there's a concern that this really means that citizens and those concerned about, for example, the impact of agriculture on the environment, particularly through groundwater contamination, might get a whole lot less consideration. And I guess I'd have to put this in a much like the budget debate in general, in terms of what has become a more polarized debate over environmental policy nationwide. There's a real split between the two parties, between Democrats and Republicans, and for reasons that puzzle me sometimes, Republicans are a little less interested in environmental protection, a little more interested in spurring economic growth. I think you see this in both proposals.
Another part of this plan that we should get to is the proposal to freeze the DNR's land conservation purchasing for an estimated 13 years until 2028. Yeah. Now, this one's been a little more contentious even among Republicans, and these land conservation purchases have happened so far under the Nelson Knowles Stewardship Program. Yeah. Can you tell us about that program and how it's worked so far?
Yeah, well, as you indicated, there's a real difference between environmentalists in this case and Republicans. Many Republicans are concerned, and I think you see the same thing on the national level with the Endangered Species Act and other land conservation programs. The concern is you're taking land that is currently privately owned and is on the tax rolls, and you're removing it for some a level of protection, not quite wilderness, but public conservation land. So you're losing the tax revenue. You're removing land from the private sector and moving it into the public sector. Republicans are also concerned about the cost involved. And the reason for this particular, one might wonder, well, what is it about the 13 years? The idea is to reduce the level of debt repayment that comes out of this program, because you purchase the land by borrowing money, much as we have proposed for transportation for highway repairs. And Republicans are concerned that the debt level has gotten to be very high, and therefore we ought to put this on hold for a while until the level of debt payment drops. And that's why the 13 years are until 2028. Environmentalists, of course, think that this has been a wonderful program. It's wildly popular. I've seen some surveys that say 90% of the Wisconsin public very much approves of it. This, of course, sets aside land that is used by hunters and fishermen and used for other recreational purposes. So it's not setting aside land that doesn't benefit the public. So there's a real split here, and it has been, as you suggested, it's been a split that's gone on for a while, where conservatives tend to think we shouldn't be moving public private land into the public sector under the stewardship program, and environmentalists say, but it's popular, and it's a way of providing services to the public, and so far we are, in fact, able to handle the debt payment. So it's a matter of judgment about whether the debt payment is the level of debt is too high or needs to be brought down.
In 2014, the DNR told legislators that the program was costing taxpayers, as you said, $1.6 million a week in terms of interest. Is it reasonable to say that this is a high number and there need to be some tweaks to this program?
Well, it's certainly reasonable to have a discussion about it. I think, as is the case with all of the budget, what everybody wants is to have a real thorough discussion of the pros and cons of the changes here, whether it has to do with the UW system or the DNR or the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program. I think, given the level of distrust in government and the contentiousness surrounding these issues, what we want is to have the public you know, express its concern and participate in the decisions. I can see an argument either way here, except from my perspective, this has been a very successful and popular program. So it's a little puzzling that out of the blue, we suddenly get a proposal to dramatically alter it, even though there's been some concern raised, as you noted, for years from conservatives about the level of debt and the cost to the taxpayers of doing this. But, you know, we spend money on lots of things, and if it serves the public interest and the public is happy with it, the level of payment is not necessarily a problem.
And just one more piece of this to get through briefly as we're getting short of time. The governor's proposal also looks to cut 66 positions from the DNR. What is your take on that so far?
Well, of course, this is part of the larger budget reduction for the DNR. You mentioned a figure earlier, a $13 million cut proposed there. We have had cuts since 2011. And the DNR staff has been shrinking. That is, this is one way you save money. When people retire or leave the agency, you do not replace them. And I think I read the particular language in the budget document. As I think many listeners know, this is a very long budget bill, 1,800 pages of details on the DNR. Specifically, what it says is we want to eliminate the positions in the DNR Science Bureau, some of which are now vacant, and in the future to rely on paid consultants. The problem is paid consultants really don't have an attachment to the DNR or even to the state of Wisconsin, and their views may be removed from the content of the program, whether it concerns
and
water.
And we have to leave it there. Michael, thank you so much for your time. We've been speaking with Michael Kraft, Professor Emeritus of Public and Environmental Affairs at the UW-Green Bay, speaking about Governor Walker's proposed changes to the state's Department of Natural Resources.
I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Many veterans' lives have been saved by modern protective technology, but that doesn't mean their time at war has come without a cost. Brain injuries have been called the signature wound of American troops returning from wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they have serious impacts on the physical, mental, and emotional lives of returning vets.
But when it comes to the science behind traumatic brain injuries, there are a lot of gray areas. What exactly causes it, what the effects are, and how to treat it. Our next guest looks at efforts from the worlds of science and art to try to come to grips with the problem.
Caroline Alexander joins us now. Her books include The Endurance, Shackleton's Legendary Antarctic Expedition, and The Bounty. Today we're talking about her National Geographic cover story, The Invisible War on the Brain. Caroline, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, the online version of your piece includes the voices of some of the veterans you talked to. I wanted to play a bit. Here's an Army First Sergeant named David talking about his experience with PTSD and traumatic brain injury.
It's those unseen scars, unseen stuff. And sometimes you find yourself saying, I wish I would have, when I got injured, I would have lost a body part. So people will see, so they'll get it. If my hand or arm or whatever just been blown off, then they would understand. They would see that there's something wrong with you, and so they'd spend the time.
So because these traumatic brain injuries, we can't see them. They're invisible to the outside observer. Is that part of why we've been slow to come to grips with the impact of traumatic brain injuries among veterans?
Very much so. Everything about this condition is inscrutable. In the first instance, it bears the symptoms of blast-induced traumatic brain injury, to use its very particular term. It appears to overlap symptomatically with those of PTSD. So, for example, somebody who's been in the field, experienced an IED, possibly at a distance, possibly not himself being or herself being blown up, might come back shaken by the event, perhaps witnessed somebody else get injured, which was very upsetting and traumatic, and months afterwards just finds that memory isn't as good as it used to be, that he might be having a little bit of difficulty finding words, can't sleep, has a headache, has ringing in his ears, but it's not the kind of thing that you would necessarily run to get treatment for. So the first thing is that the symptoms themselves can be subtle, a little unquantifiable, and appear also to overlap with just stress or post-traumatic stress syndrome. So the symptoms are difficult to quantify on the one hand, and then there has been, up until just about now, this moment almost, very little effective technologies that allow us to look inside the brain for the kind of damage that blast is inflicting. It seems to be causing damage at the microtissue level, and there just aren't mechanisms. There's a hint of them coming that have allowed one to look into the brain of a living soldier and report back and say, yes, we can see something here, something is wrong with you.
And the causes of these injuries, you mentioned IEDs, the improvised explosive devices. You also in your piece talk about breaching, getting through a wall or a door or a fortification by intentionally setting off an explosive. As I read what you're writing about, it seems like concussions from these blasts at levels way lower than we would have previously thought can cause these kind of brain injuries.
Yes, there's a lot that we're learning, and the breachers were, in a way, the canaries in the mine shaft. The breachers are the guys like the Navy SEALs who burst, exploded away into the Bin Laden's compound. They're the people who set controlled explosives offensively to get into structures, usually. And so these are people who, there had been a lot of anecdotal reports that they appeared to be suffering symptoms of neurological conditions, but it was all a little bit anecdotal. So a study was done in 2008, which followed a group of breacher instructors over a two-week training period, and the training was on home turf, which is to say in the United States. So this was very clarifying, because you had a group of guys who were professionals, who enjoyed, in fact, what they did, who weren't suffering from PTSD, and who weren't getting blown off their feet. They weren't being experienced, you know, where they were knocked out or knocked unconscious or anything like that. And at the end of the two-week period, it was found that they manifested signs of neuro... They performed less well on their neurobehavioral tests than they had 2 weeks previously. So this was a real wake-up call, because suddenly people realize all those thresholds that we have for measuring whether people are at risk for damage are based on false assumptions. So in the past, it was, did you lose consciousness? Were you unconscious for this amount of time or that amount of time? But now it appears that low-level exposure to low-level blast is also damaging, particularly, it seems, when it's repetitive. And it's not strictly concussion. It appears not to be the kind of injury that we get in blunt force trauma, such as, I say, a football head injury or an automobile accident where your head is concussed. And so many of the neurologists I spoke with were advocated new terminology entirely, such as blast-induced neurotrauma, just to distinguish it from the, you know, more conventional concussions we know of in the civilian world.
Now, the scary and sad thing here is that in many of these cases, someone has just been wounded, possibly for life. They don't know that they've been wounded. There's no blood. There's no shrapnel. There's no immediate indication that they've been hit in a way.
Exactly. Very much so. And I mean, one of the veterans I spoke with, who has now been securely dosed with traumatic brain injury, himself, in a way, both self-diagnosed, understood, knew some years down the line that there was something wrong with him, and then this was sort of confirmed by the clinical observation conducted by the doctors. He describes, you know, the event that he now knows was sort of the final straw. He'd been exposed to some other events before, but he knows that this one kind of tipped him over the edge. But he came to, in this case, he was knocked out, and he came to his senses, and the first thing he did was look for blood, and there was no blood. So he thought he was good. You know, it's like all my limbs are here. I can see. I can speak. I know where I am. I escaped. And then you have to think that tours of duty come to an end. You're safe home. You've made it. Maybe your buddies didn't make it. Maybe they're severely injured. You feel yourself to be very much the lucky one. And the adjustment back to civilian life is a little bit trickier than you thought. You find you're fumbling with things that you thought you could do well. But you wouldn't necessarily jump to the conclusion that this is real damage. And so this is where this dreadful gray zone appears, because it's very difficult, even now, even with the condition sort of on the table and people really concerned about it, it's still very hard to determine precisely if somebody has this or indeed is just suffering is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder or just readjusting. The two most diagnostic symptoms are a headache that doesn't go away, migraine-type headache, and ringing in your ears. Those are symptoms that are not do not overlap with post-traumatic stress disorder or any psychological adjustment issue. So those would be clearly indicative of something else, of the physiological damage.
Is there a thought that maybe some of what we thought was PTSD all along is actually this blast-related traumatic brain injury?
That's a very good question, and the answer is yes. There's a strong belief now, and this is particularly relevant to the high rate of suicides that have followed in the wake of the campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan, that it is strongly thought now that exposure to blast, that the language that's used is quite cautious, but they say sort of predispose or make enhance vulnerabilities to certain psychiatric conditions. And that's a sort of medicalese way of saying that they believe, you know, all our emotional states, cognitive states, obviously originate in the brain, in the physical brain. And so if the physical brain is actually injured, it's not surprising that there would be, you know, that our self-expression, whether intellectually or emotionally, would go awry. And so this is now very much what people are starting to quantify and or attempt to quantify. It's still, and the other thing is there's a genuine overlap, which is to say that if you've, you know, been exposed to a blast event, it is traumatic. You undoubtedly would have some kind of psychological trauma that one would carry out from that event, but you may also have the other, the physiological condition. And so right now it's a kind of waiting game, waiting to see how the condition reasserts itself down the line in years to come. So the only thing that doctors can do at this point is sort of advocate vigilance on the part of VAs or other medical practitioners, services that actually have to treat or see or interact with veterans on the one hand, and vigilance on the part of veterans for themselves and for friends that they know who were also in combat, so that they can sort of track, because really right now it's only observational. It's only by self-expressing your symptoms in a way that many, you know, that a diagnosis can be made.
We're talking to Caroline Alexander about her National Geographic piece looking at the impact of brain injuries on U.S. veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And you can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. If you're a veteran of these conflicts, is this something that's affected you or maybe other people in your unit? Or maybe you have a family member dealing with these problems. If you work in healthcare, have you worked with veterans showing these symptoms? You can call and share what you've seen at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, get a little into the science and the art involved in trying to heal these veterans after a look at the headlines with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. We continue our conversation with Caroline Alexander. She wrote about traumatic brain injuries for U.S. veterans in her National Geographic cover story. It's called The Invisible War on the Brain.
And you can join in. Is this an issue that has affected you or someone close to you? Do you have questions about the research and treatment of these brain injuries in veterans? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go to our callers, Caroline, an interesting point you brought up in your piece. Going back to World War One, the phrase shell shock actually may have been closer to the mark for a lot of injured World War One soldiers than we thought in the years since.
Absolutely. In fact, that's what drew me into the story. I've done quite a bit of research on World War One, and I had done a story on shell shock, and I was immersed in the medical literature of that era. And this was about the time that the news media started reporting on a strange new condition or perplexing condition that was manifesting itself in veterans in Iraq. And it was, you know, it looked like it was PTSD, but it also looked like it had something else going on as well. And I would get used to just reading almost as a kind of exercise down the paragraph, waiting for where it would come and note that it would say that the individual in question had been exposed to a blast event. It was just like seeing a mirror of what had happened in World War One. And I certainly feel that part of that, that medical knowledge could have been further ahead than it is now had the medical community over the past century kind of continued caring about this issue. It's quite remarkable. You have the signature injury of the most catastrophic war possibly in world history, which was shell shock, left hundreds of thousands, millions of men with this condition. And then it was as if the world just heaved a big sigh of relief and said, well, that's over. You know, we won't bother with it. And then lo and behold, 100 years passes, and we're once again in a kind of a conflict that makes great use of explosive force. And one of the reasons I wrote the story was I don't want the same thing to happen to the modern veterans that happened to the veterans of 100 years ago, which is essentially that they got forgotten. And, you know, it's really instructive to think that for decades of my life, there were still veterans alive in old age from World War One, and they were languishing in places, you know, you never saw them, never heard of them, never thought about them. But that's what happens. History, you know, moves very quickly, and we tend to forget one conflict and put it behind us and then move on to the next big issue. And so I think it's very important now, while there's, you know, there's interest in this, and it's, you know, I wanted to sort of put it on the table, have people pay attention, because whatever policies we make now are what people are going to live with down the line.
Let's bring a caller into the conversation. Ian is with us in Milwaukee. Ian, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Ian?
I just was calling in with kind of a firsthand example that I've had. I my best friend since I was 9 until about 18, we were next door neighbors, inseparable, and then we kind of, you know, separated at the end of high school. And his route was to kind of like succumb to the recruiter. He was a big guy. He liked video games, and they I don't mean to say lured, but he was kind of lured in. He was a very innocent, big teddy bear, and then. Flash forward 2 years, I haven't seen him in 1 year is training and 1 year is Afghanistan, and he comes back with a different look in his eye. He's not, he's still there, but it's like a, almost like a whipped dog look, because it's just, it's not comparable to living here for most of his life. So he comes back, and we kind of have like this one night we were drinking, and he kind of starts telling me just kind of weird things, and he starts getting really weird with holding a knife and stuff, and I couldn't believe that's like where my friend had gotten to, and I very angry, but I don't really hang out with him because it hurts me to see it, and since then I hear rumors of body counts and things like that, and it's like he went in there, I know, as my innocent friend, and that's what kind of like happened to him. And
Ian, thank you so much for calling. I wanted to bring Caroline Alexander here. Now, this could be a case of PTSD. It could be a traumatic brain injury or something else. But you talk to a lot of veterans who have been diagnosed with traumatic brain injury. Is there that sense that they feel like a different person? The people who know them see them as a different person after this injury?
Yes. I thought it was a very moving story. Mm-hmm. It's one I've heard a lot. And indeed, in our in the National Geographic story, the what we try to do for those who haven't seen it yet is there's the text is very much about the science, if you will, but the illustrations are very unusual, and they're masks that the veterans painted of their own faces, showing how they feel themselves inside themselves, the things they can't express verbally, and they're horrific. I mean, they're tortured faces, and so that. And that whipped dog look, that horrifying expression, is something that one of the mothers describes of her son when he came back, you know, that she just looked in his eyes and he wasn't the same person. The other thing to just note, you know, if you have friends that you're concerned about, one of the places that seems to be getting damaged a lot is the frontal lobe, which is the part of the brain that controls your executive function. It's your control mechanism, it's your impulse management center. And so it's thought possibly that one of the reasons there's so many suicides is because it's almost like you have a teenage brain. It hasn't quite formed in a teenager, and they do impulsive, stupid things, like pull a knife on somebody. And so I would, you know, it could be PTSD, as you rightly said. But if there's any concern, I suggest, you know, that all that one can do is counsel whoever you know, if they have these troubling symptoms, to just go in and see, go to the VA, go to a doctor, and describe their history in warfare. Were they exposed to any blast events? And try and get some help for this, some ways of managing it.
Ian, thanks for calling and sharing that, and good luck to your friend. We'll go now to Stefan in Madison. Stefan, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. I was a senior explosive ordnance disposal technician, so we were the guys actually defusing bombs. And my question is regarding to the cumulativeness of these different exposures. So when we judge an explosion, we would relate to it in K factors, which in turn relates to PSI. And I was wondering if there's a specific PSI that the patient has to be exposed to in order for these individual events to become cumulative.
Stefan, thanks for that call. PSI would be pounds per square inch, right?
Pounds per square inch.
And do we know if there's that threshold established yet?
No, we don't. And first of all, I should say, I think we will know soon. There's a paper that will be coming out sometime this year that I think is going to be greatly clarifying by showing exactly what it is that's damaged in the brain, and I think we can work backwards from that. So we don't know safety standoff distances. We don't know what the PSI thresholds are. One of the things that's darkly fascinating, though, to me, is when you look at these safety sheets that are handed out, you know, that this number of PSI, you'll rupture your eardrum, this much will hurt your lungs, this much will do this and that and the other, this much is fatality. The brain is not even in it. I mean, it just is astonishing in retrospect that with all the internal organs that people were concerned about with trying to establish these thresholds, which it turns out were wrong, that the brain was never even considered. And it shows, you know, how much behind the curve we're starting with this research.
Stefan, thanks for the call. Good luck. And thanks for doing that dangerous work. Caroline, you'd mentioned that mask project that some of these veterans had been doing. And by the way, we've got a link to some pictures of that that you had. We've got that at the Central Time Facebook page. You talk about one veteran who thought, why am I doing this? This isn't kindergarten. Why am I painting with this little brush? But
yeah,
he turned around on it.
Well, it's the program is run out of Walter Reed, and it's an art therapy program. And it's a form, I know it's been used, for example, with abused children. And also, by the way, art therapy was used in World War I. So it's a well-documented form of emotional release. So is meditation, by the way, which is something that one of the top rehab docs told me that. But these, it has to be stressed, help treat the psychological aspect of the injury. They don't heal the brain, and there is nothing that heals the brain at the moment that is known of. All we have are management systems. So if one is diagnosed with TBI, the best type of treatment you're going to get will be trying to address each of those symptoms, whether it's sleeplessness or headaches or anger or impulse or anxiety, and each of those will be treated in a different way. And the art therapy, the mask making, speaks to one aspect of that management, but it would be false to imply that it is in some sense, it's solace. It gives solace, it gives release, it gives expression, but it doesn't actually heal you.
Caroline, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Caroline Alexander. She's a contributing writer for National Geographic magazine. She wrote the magazine's February cover story, The Invisible War on the Brain. We have that piece linked over at the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.